Welcome. Allow this next minute as a sacred time and space for you to settle and arrive. We will begin shortly. Welcome. I am Rabbi Chasya Uriel Steinbauer, the founder and director of the Institute for Holiness, Mechon LeKedusha, Kehilat Musar, the Musar community. I'm delighted that you have taken time out of your day to commit to your practice, to take refuge in community and in the Dharma and in God. Delighted to have you here. This is our weekly series. We meet every Sunday at 12:30 Eastern Standard Time, 7:30 p.m. here in Haaretz and Israel. And for wherever you may be logging in, you're welcome to let us know in the chat or in the chat on live stream, which we are doing on our YouTube channel or on our Facebook page. As you all know, and for those of you who are new to this, every week we jump into an active interpretation and encounter with the weekly Torah portion, the Hebrew Bible, as we Jews study it weekly. And this week we are jumping into Shalach, sometimes known as Shalach Lecha. And for here in Israel, in Haaretz, we already chanted and learned and listened to this Torah portion this past Shabbat. And everyone Chutz La'aretz, everyone outside of Israel, you're going to be studying and hearing this chanted in synagogues throughout your countries and homes this coming Shabbat. So today on Sunday, June 19th, 2022, we are here on the 20th of Sivan, the Hebrew month of Sivan, 5782, Tav Shin Pei Bet. And we will jump into this Torah portion and take a look at it from the lens and practice of Musar mindfulness, seeing what we can extract lessons for our own practice and lives as we are on this path, on the noble eightfold path and on the holy path of Musar towards holiness. So you are welcome, and anyone is welcome, Jew, non-Jew, into this amazing practice of Musar mindfulness, where we take this wonderful synergy from the Dharma and from Musar and strengthen both and learn from both ancient wisdoms. So you're welcome to find out more information about our institute at our website and following us on any of the mediums and social media. So let's jump in. I'm going to start off with a summary of what kind of the main thing that I'm going to discuss from the Torah portion. And then I'll begin to do a little bit of an analysis, and then we'll move into actually a guided seated meditation together. And sometimes we have Q&A, question and answer afterwards. It really depends who's showing up, who's here. So before we begin all of this, we always begin with our kavanot, our intentions for today's practice. Why do we do this? Because we know from spiritual discipline and practice that when you come in, when you have an intention for your day, for what you're doing, you're more likely to not only follow through and do it, but it's like more fulfilling on a spiritual level and more effective, both in the brain science research. So we have three kavanot in front of us, and normally I do the first two, the first and the last. But what we're going to realize is we've been practicing this. We're now in our 38th sitting together. Mazal tov, congratulations. I feel jazzed tonight, excited. As in our 38th sitting, we have come to learn, as I've learned from my own teacher, Joseph Goldstein, that this practice is not only a radical act of self-care, it is a radical act of social justice. It is taking care of the self. It is doing acts on behalf of the other and strengthening our relationship with the divine. It is that holy triangle that we're constantly in relationship with God, with others, meaning community and ourselves. So that's what we're jumping in with our kavanot. So we want to say, before doing acts of care for the self, and before doing this practice now together for others, and doing this practice now to strengthen our relationship with the divine, we want to say to ourselves and have this intention, this is what I'm doing right now with the Institute of Holiness. I'm committing to this half hour, 45 minutes practice together, where I'm doing this to strengthen my own soul and to strengthen my relationship to others and to strengthen my relationship with the Creator so that I can be a benefit to others in the future, so I can be a better conduit of God's good to others when they need me. So this is our intention. This is our kavanah for today. May we merit bringing peace and wisdom to the world, cause less suffering and harm. So what do we witness today in Shelach? We witness God Moshe, and I word it this way, our ancestor Moshe. We witness Moshe, I will say, but it could be debated, sending 12 of our ancestors, known as scouts or spies. Perhaps it's a military exposition, not 100% clear. Out, they're called Meraglim. They're sent out to check out the land of Canaan. There right now, our ancestors are still in the desert. I think it's actually in Midbar Paran. They are outside the land of Canaan, and they are sending out these scouts to check out the land. They are gone for 40 days. Immediately, you should have little bells go off if you've been following along and also follow the Torah and Hebrew Bible. 40 days, who else was gone for 40 days? Moshe Rabbeinu. Does B'nai Israel like it when somebody's gone for 40 days? No. Okay, so this should already, if we're going to have associative thinking, and if we're not going to meet something directly in the present moment as if it's a clean new slate, we're going to instead come with our old ideas and associations, which is so classic in our Torah learning, right? 40 days, they are out, these spies, these scouts, scouting the land. They return and they start off giving a review of their experience. Okay. They share first what I would label as a neutral assessment, saying the land indeed is flowing with milk and honey. This is the fruit of the land. Okay. And then they give another report that the people are very large that they saw and encountered. The cities are well fortified, and the Amalekites, wrong group, are dwelling in the land. Okay, still could be interpreted as neutral, especially if this is a military expedition. They're coming and just reporting what they're seeing. Okay, but even that second part, when you communicate as a leader, and these are leaders that were sent out. When you communicate this as a leader in front of all the people, so it's not sure, are they reporting this to just Moshe? The people are overhearing. There begins a little bit of a murmur, like, people are big and the cities are fortified. Okay, so that starts. And then all of a sudden, wise speech goes out the door. If there's one thing that we're going to learn from this week's Parsha, it is a Torah portion and a lesson of self-restraint and of wise speech and the lack thereof, okay? And how quickly unwise speech leads to panic and leads to violence or even the threat of violence. And so what happens next is they first start off saying, the land you sent us to. You have to be very careful. Torah is very precise on its speech, and it teaches us that we need to be very precise because there's always somebody listening, particularly if we're a leader. Always someone listening, and we'll take it very concretely. Okay? And it's meant to be there. It's meant to signify something. So here we are. the land you, Moshe, sent us to, not the land which God, the Lord, Hashem promised, which is always how it's been worded. So already we're noticing something with this speech. Okay. We are in chapter 13 and we're looking at the verses 25 through 33. And next we move to, which pasuk is this? This is 32. Okay, 32 to 33. These are very important because this is when the shift takes place. We move from speech, you know, as we learn in our Dharma practice and the mindfulness practice, that we can label something as unpleasant, as neutral, and as pleasant. So we can see this speech starting off as neutral, and it's moving towards the unpleasant. And then it gets really ugly. And what I mean by that is Israel had hesitated up until now, its leaders. And all of a sudden, what we get here is in this pasuk here, they say that the country that we traversed and scouted, here I'm looking at 32. Let's see here. Okay. So, Haaretz asher avanu ba'va latur otah eretz ochelet yoshveha hi. Wow. Okay, what does that mean? The country that we scouted and traversed is one that eats, that devours its settlers, the people who dwell and settle in that land. What? That's really, where did we get that? Like, all of a sudden we are told the land is indeed flowing with milk and honey, and this is the fruit from the land. And yes, the people are large and the cities are fortified. Obviously, the cities are packed with people, meaning people are dwelling, and many people are dwelling just fine. So where is this statement coming from? So all of a sudden you're realizing with these scouts is their experience of it, at least 9 of the 10 scouts, which we'll get to, is one in which they're reacting, first of all, and that's fear-based, which leads to a bit of delusion. It leads to using a metaphor to discuss the land. The land devours its settlers. Could you imagine as a leader saying this in front of your people and your populace? Not that you're solely responsible for their reactions, but this is just, it's not called for and it's not wise speech. So they say this, and you can imagine former slaves who actually haven't learned a new way of being, who are actually having major post-traumatic stress disorder from the institution of slavery, don't know any other way to behave except for this cycle of reaction. And so they hear this and they freak out, right? Okay, so obviously you could say a healthy person who doesn't have post-traumatic stress disorder obviously is responsible for their own reaction. And so we could, you know, pray and hope that B'nai Israel on some of them would be more responsible with their reaction to hearing this, that they would be able to assess and go, is this really true? And maybe it was just your experience. And how can that be based on what you shared with us earlier? Even Abravanel, one of our wonderful rabbinic commentators, comments on this. He's like, you know, this metaphor is usually described to describe the land's infertility. And if so, the scouts would have been guilty of self-contradiction, since they unequivocally affirm the land's fertility and abundant population. So we're holding on to that. Okay, we're holding on to this like delusion that's beginning out of fear. And then they go on to say that they see these giants there, right? But in particular, they say this language, right? We look like grasshoppers. We look like grasshoppers to ourselves. In our own eyes, we appear like grasshoppers. Okay? And so we must have looked that way to them. So fear, low self-esteem, low self-worth, with a lack of courage based on fear. They don't see themselves as worthy. Almost they don't even see themselves as children of God, being guided and held by Hashem, meaning they can feel strong, they can feel able. That's not there yet. That has not been internalized. And so coming from this, from a Musar mindfulness perspective, you would feel compassion for these people, feel compassion for Bnei Israel's reaction, knowing that they probably could not react any differently. Compassion for the nine scouts who have gotten caught up in their own delusion and fear. And you would want that from Moshe, and you would want that from God. We don't get that. This is going to be one of the more difficult parshiot because there's no compassion here. So let's delve in. Okay. There's actually a beautiful midrash that I'll mention before we move into our meditation practice about how God sees this statement where they say that we appear like grasshoppers to ourselves and we must have been that way towards them. It's a beautiful, we'll move into it. Okay. So what I want to say is that the people chose to listen to the negative report, and they react with screaming and crying and even threatening Moshe and Aharon and perhaps Yeshua and Caleb. So let me introduce you to Caleb if you haven't read this portion yet. Caleb is one of our ancestors. He's actually not an Israelite. He is a non-Israelite, a non-Jew who chose to become a part of the Jewish people on this journey through the desert. He is one of the scouts, the spies that heads off. He is separate because he does not react. He uses wise speech. He actually honors their first analysis and even second, that the people are large and the cities are fortified. He never denies what they've said as truth. What he instead, it's not even a denial. What he does is he speaks with positive speech that we can go ahead. We have God with us. We can go and do this. We can colonize, conquer the land. And he's someone who has unbelievable faith and trust, and he models it. And so there, it's quite beautiful that he is there and he is trying to model for us and be this example of wise speech, of equanimity, meaning he's aware of all the craziness that's going around him, but he stays centered and he speaks and he tries to address it with either neutral or even pleasant speech. So, you know, to kind of contain what has kind of been released like fire in the forest. So God reacts, and it almost reacts in a way that you would say, if God were a human character, that God was taking this personally. That's how it's encountered and how it feels. And so God immediately wants to wipe this people out. Now, who knows if this is really true? Who knows if this was a response in order to see how Moshe would respond? We can't know, but it's not the reaction that, at least when I'm studying this, that I want. Okay, so Moshe responds very intelligently, and you should recall, you're going to have one of those moments again. Okay, he has very high emotional intelligence. He knows that Hashem, God, has this desire and plan to be seen and recognized as the one, right? The all-powerful mover, all-powerful God. And since the people were brought up out of slavery with the signs and wonders and the miracles and the plagues, the whole thing's been set to display the use of Bnei Israel, the Israelites, to make God appear as this all-powerful mover. And so he immediately knows that he says to Hashem, if you go ahead and destroy these people, you will appear weak. You will not appear as the all-powerful God that can move these people from slavery to the land of milk and honey. And so that's the first argument. He has three. So who else prepared three ways of behaving to try to cause the best qualities to come out in someone? You might recall Yaakov, our ancestor Yaakov, when his brother Esav is coming with 400 men to greet him after 20 years after he stole Esau's blessing, and they haven't spoken to one another or seen one another. He approaches his brother with like 550 animals, gift. He approaches him and he splits up the camps in case they go to war, so only one camp will end up being murdered. And then, of course, he beseeches God. He prays to God. So here we have Moshe. He does three things. So first, he appeals to this all-powerful God that they will appear weak and won't have finished the task that they set out to do. The second is the oath that God had made between in the Brit, the covenant between Avraham, Avinu, our ancestor, Avraham, and of course, Yitzhak and Yaakov, this promising them that our people will be taken to the land of Canaan. And the last, of course, is mercy. He calls out God's mercy. Of course, mercy doesn't mean complete forgiveness, as if the slate is wiped clean and there's no consequences for one's behavior. This is the type of mercy where they will not be destroyed. Calling on God's mercy, okay? So this works in the sense that these three reminders and arguments from Moshe to God work enough to not destroy the people immediately. What I mean by that is we now witness, and this started last week in our last week Torah portion, Baha'u'l-Techa, this kind of emergence of the new form of justice, of deen, of what we call mida keneged mida, a measure for measure, this sense, it's almost like Jewish karma, in the sense that what God perceives B'nai Israel is doing wrong, it is met with that type of equal punishment, so shall be done. The problem with this, obviously, is the spies were out for 40 days, and for every day, God punishes them with a year. So it turns into 40 years. So this is really not mida keneged mida. This is like mida keneged tenfold. Okay. So we have to keep that in mind, but we have to ask ourselves, is this justice? Is this deen? Maybe. Is this righteousness? No. Is this rachamim? Because righteousness is really this beautiful, you know, tzedakah, is this beautiful mixture of deen and rachamim. We're not witnessing necessarily. So something important happens, though, at the end of our parsha that's, I think, trying to, we always get this when there's been so much judgment and then violence in the sense of, so what happens with the people is some of them end up being killed because they decide to go off. They decide, oh, we'll go to the land of Canaan, and they go to enter, and they end up being killed by some of the other people because God's not with them. And then you also have the punishment in the sense that the people will spend the rest of the time, 40 years in the desert, so that they will essentially die out. What I will say to this is, it's this generation with the post-traumatic stress disorder who've just come out of the institution of slavery, who really don't know better, maybe even don't have the skills to behave or do any better, that will need to, in a way. They will be the ones who will die out in the desert. Their children, anyone under the age of 20, will enter the land of Canaan. So, but we always see when we have this great kind of consequence, violence, karma that is meted out and visited upon B'nai Israel, we always see kind of a tikkun, a repair come afterwards that in all honesty should be there before, because had it been there before, maybe this harm and suffering wouldn't have happened. So what do I mean by that? Something very important comes at the end of our parsha, towards the end, where it is commanded. So you could either say, like, it is commanded that the people wear tzitzit, these ritual fringes on the four corners of their garment, on their clothing. And generally, the way we think that works is they wore really long gowns, dresses, robes, that they would have them in the corner. And the point of these tzitzit are to remind the people. So first of all, to become awake and alert, become mindful, and to be remember the commandments, remember their path towards holiness, okay? Remember their relationship. So let's just start off by saying whether it is God that commands this way of being or the actual cultural phenomenon of the ancient Near East, of what we witness just go on with the people and this kind of mida keneged mida, meaning like a measure for measure justice. We witness, as I said, at the end of this parsha, it's almost like an acknowledgement of a mistake. It's not worded this way. It's just the subtle experience of it. If you hone in on it, this acknowledgement that the people, B'nai Israel, our ancestors, like all people, not only need a rule of law, hence what they were brought out of slavery for, but they will also need cultural and spiritual practices, signs and reminders to help pull them out of their habitual mindlessness, out of their trauma, out of their reactions, out of their delusion, to choose mindfulness, wise discernment, to do what is right and just. That is the mitzvah of tzitzit. The tzitzit are a mindfulness tool. You are to see them. It is an embodied practice. It is a sensual experience, like meditation, experiential. It is there to help you stop reacting, creating the space between the match and the fuse, to be able to remember how we are to behave, remember the mitzvot, the commandments on this path towards holiness. Just as in our Dharma practice, when we sit in mindfulness meditation, coming to mindfulness to remember the sila, the Pali word meaning virtue, morality, and ethics, this non-harming, and the five precepts, which are not stealing, not committing sexual misconduct, not speaking wrong or unwise speech, not killing, not consuming intoxicants that could and would cloud the mind. So our ancestors, our rabbis, love to say that sight leads to memory. Memory leads to action. So the sight of the tzitzit, the sight, the embodied practice of the sitting, meditation, the mindfulness, these all lead to memory. They all lead to action, proper action. So these precepts, just like the mitzvot in Judaism, in our commandments, are the indispensable foundation for our whole spiritual path. The ethics, the morality, the musar. So in closing, we begin to see this constant erosion of trust in the relationship between the people and Moshe, between Moshe and the people, between the people and God. And this has consequences. This has karma. And we're witnessing it. We were going to witness it like we witnessed it last week. We're going to witness it in Shalach Lacha and Shalach. You're going to witness it next week also. And Korach. Okay. So we come full circle. The people are starting to wear their gowns, their dresses with the tzitzit as a reminder. This tzitzit, this is a clothing that the Kohanim only had worn before. Again, we're this tikkun, this recognizing by God that perhaps the people need to be a little bit more involved and not be denied access to that which is only privileged to the Kohanim and Leviim. that they too be involved in holiness. So this the parsha closes even saying, like last week we had the Nazir, who was contained and allowed to behave in a sense, who wanted to be like the Kohen Agadol, right? The high priest. So here we have that the people can become holy to God through the practice and observance of tzitzit, which is what the Kohen had worn. Okay, the Kohen named the priest. So this is the full circle. We're having a tikkun that, of course, we wish in hindsight had been there before, that maybe had Bnei Israel been wearing these tzitzit, and even the scouts, the leaders, had they been wearing them, maybe they would have paused in their speech and thought, is this helpful? Is this helpful to speak this way right now in front of everyone? What would be the consequences of such behavior? Okay, so may we all practice, live the precepts and the mitzvot, the commandments, to merit Ruach Acheret. Ruach Acheret, which it technically translates into a different spirit, another spirit. And that is what Kalev, the one scout who spoke with wise speech, with that neutrality, that equanimity, he is called someone who has a Ruach Acheret. May we all merit through our practice to be mindful, to act with wisdom, to stay on the path. May our essentially, how do I want to word this to you? May our scouting in our lives, right? Our checking out something not lead us to astray. May we learn from our ancestors in this Torah portion. So I will close with the imagination exercise that we move into our meditation. So we have a midrash coming from Numbers Rabbah, chapter 16, Pasuk 11, where the scouts have clearly panicked back at our old scene, and the panic infects the people. And God's reaction is conjured up in this midrash. So it says, God says, I take no objection to your saying that we look like grasshoppers, meaning God's having compassion towards them. Well, they have low self-esteem. They're not feeling courageous. They're not trusting. So God's saying, I have no objection to you saying we look like grasshoppers to ourselves, but I do take offense when you say, so we must have looked so to them. Interesting. So how do you know how I made you look to them? God is asking Bnei Israel, how do you know how I made you look to them? We can't know that. We can't know how someone else is going to experience us. So we have to remain open to that experience, right? And so God says finally at the end, perhaps you appeared to them as angels, as malachim. Isn't that just beautiful? Imagine if the scouts had said, perhaps we appeared like angels to them. I might feel small. I might feel like I'm a shrimp, a grasshopper. So this is part of the meditation practice, is to engage sometimes in that imaginary practice, imagining what would have been like if our ancestors instead had said, we might appear as angels to them. Maybe it wouldn't even have led to necessarily this conquest or colonization. Maybe it would have been a sharing or a different response. So with that, we move into our guided mindfulness meditation practice that I will lead you. So for any of you coming to this session with any trauma, meaning you're aware that you have post-traumatic stress disorder, or that it's been coming up lately in your sitting meditation practice, maybe an old trauma, I want you to sit with your eyes open. And if you feel comfortable closing them, go ahead. But the minute you feel that something that is not helpful, healthy, life-affirming to you, that you open your eyes and come back to the reality that you are in this room with me, in this Zoom space, this sacred space together, and that you are here, that you're not in the trauma, okay? For the rest of us, if you're able to sit, you're not having any chronic pain or issues with the low back, come to a seated upright position, dignified, created in the likeness and image of the divine. you need to lie down, go ahead and do so with your eyes open, really, I say, when you're lying down, so you remain awake and alert. If you need to stand, go ahead and do so, or do a walking meditation. So today's sitting is actually going to be in honor of my teacher, Joseph Goldstein, who teaches that we can come to neutrality and seeing things more as neutral, and even eventually into the practice where I take it of giving the benefit of the doubt like angels. Okay, so we're going to move into a practice on judgment and how judgment comes up in our practice, which is very common. So let me just pull up my notes here. No. Thank you for your patience. So you come to an upright seated position, and we'll begin with three deep cleansing breaths. With each in-breath, bringing in mindfulness. With each exhalation, settle and arrive. Notice how your shoulders begin to relax. With each exhalation, they will begin to fall. You may say to yourself, as a form of mental noting, I am awake, I am alert, I am here. Allowing the breath to come to its own natural rhythm. Noticing if you have any thoughts that are carrying you off to the past, reminiscing about something. Becoming awake to that, not with judgments, but with compassion and kindness. Simply recognizing it, that alone wakes you up and brings you back to the present moment. For others of us, it'll be planning for the future. Our thoughts will be occupied and caught up in something that we are thinking about after this session. For others of us, it might be strong emotions or even sensations in the body that are carrying our attention away from the present moment, from your anchor, which is usually your breath. It can be my voice, the sounds around you. If you feel safe and ready, you may close your eyes or just simply lower your gaze. So much judgment passes in this parasha, in this weekly Torah portion. And we may look to this as, how can we be less judgmental and more compassionate, both with ourselves and towards others? Often in this practice, as we become more aware of our thoughts, seeing how they come, they might have a certain shelf life and they pass. As we become more aware of how ephemeral and how many there are, we also can be astonished at how many judging thoughts that may even be unkind occur. So first I will say that negative critical thinking and thoughts, they are a part of all of us. First, we just want to acknowledge these thoughts, these emotions, recognizing them. It is so common. So we're not attempting to hope that they will dissipate or go away. This is a form of aversion, pushing them away. The same thing if we become attached to them and begin to identify with them, thinking, oh, I'm so judgmental, telling ourselves a story. We are not our thoughts. So rather, the path is simply first recognizing that we're having them, watching them in our mind, recognizing that they really are fed in these two ways, either attaching them ourselves to them or aversion, attempting to push them away, be in denial of them, whether it be self-judgment or judgment about others. As we have them, it's so common, as I said earlier, to believe them. And that's a way of feeding them. It's a way of identifying with them. So it's very interesting to learn that this is just the workings of the mind. We all have judgmental thoughts. So the question is, how do we find that golden mean, that middle way between believing them and identifying with them or judging the judging? One of the techniques that is found useful and helpful in this practice is that over in your practice, right, even right now in these next moments of meditation, is to start counting the judgments, whether it be self-judgment or judgment towards others, one judgment, two judgment, 598 judgments, 3,037 judgments. It's really seeing how high the number goes. When what happens almost invariably is at a certain point, you will begin to smile. We will begin to see the ridiculousness of it. We will see that they will come, these judgmental thoughts, and they will pass. And as soon as we can begin to offer a bit of relief, of smiling at the ridiculousness of it, right? At the judging mind, we smile. We are no longer taking them so seriously, and we're no longer having aversion to them. We're simply seeing them. We are simply witnesses to them. Imagine if our ancestors had instead they had heard the report of the spies, only to be met with a smile of self-compassion and compassion, knowing, oh, you're having judgmental mind, you're having fear, delusion. So we're understanding this judgmental mind is simply being empty thoughts passing through the mind. We're not holding on to them, being lost in them and caught by them. And we're not strengthening them. When we practice aversion to try to run away from something, to try to be in denial, we're strengthening that thing. So if this is a pattern that you find in your practice or in life, especially right now together, I would say just making this experiment, whether it be right now, later in the day, or even throughout your whole day as a mindfulness practice, just one sitting or a few sittings, you start counting and see how high you can go. And if you're so inclined, please send me your top number at our email at rabbichasya@kehilatmusar.com. We will enter silent meditation for the next 5 minutes. I will ring the bells. Allowing your breath or the sounds around you to be your anchor, to bring yourself back to the present moment. As our teacher Joseph Goldstein likes to say, simply begin again. See if there has been an opening for you, a change from when you began this practice together, meditation today. Has there been a shift, a softening, an opening? Perhaps less judgment towards our ancestors, towards Moshe, towards God. Our ancestors and our rabbis, and even today, many students I encounter are so judgmental towards our ancestors, almost angry at them, seeing them as immature babies complaining in the desert. We must remember this is a people coming out of slavery, traumatized, living with and surviving their trauma, doing the best they can, which is not very wise, not very mature. It's not often what we want it to be. And that is our own practice and work, not theirs. Slowly and gently open your eyes if they were closed. Offering a bow to your practice, to the Dharma, to the Buddha who offered this to us, to God who offered us Torah and Musar, to taking refuge in this community together. May we merit our kavanot, our intention for today, to bring God's good to others, to bring benefit to the other. It's part of this practice of carrying the burden. I thank you for your practice today. We will meet again next Sunday, Bezrat Hashem, God willing, the same time, 12:30 Eastern Standard Time. You can always find us again on our website for more information on our offerings. Please do offer your donations for today's sitting, which you may do so at the website or being in touch with us. It will also be available on Insight Timer and, of course, on audio on Spotify and other mediums. We welcome sponsorship for each session in this series. This is the 38th sitting, Mazal Tov. But is in honor of somebody or in memory. May their memory be a blessing, be for a blessing. And memory is someone who has passed, who has transitioned. So do be in touch with your comments and questions. Consider subscribing to our newsletter and list, and of course, joining our community. Thank you again. Be safe and take care.